Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Missing Frames. In case you were wondering, this is the podcast where we watch movies we absolutely, probably, definitely should have seen by this point in our lives. I'm your host, Sean Eastridge, and I'm very excited because joining me for his first ever episode is Mr. Tristan Riddell. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great. So glad to be here. Thank you so much for having me on. I was going back into the memory banks, and I said, I was like, wait, this isn't my first Missing Frames, but it is my first Missing Frames. This is one of those shows that I listen to every single week. I should say every time it's out. And I love it so much. I love this concept. I love you as a host. And we talk a lot. You know, like, we chat a lot, we text a lot, and so I feel like I've been on the show, but I haven't.
Well, no, keep going about how you love me so much and how you love the show. I mean, I liked where we were going with that. I think you're absolutely amazing.
I would love it if you released more. I would love it if you released on schedule.
I think we should just scrap the entire plan for this episode and just talk about how much you love me. No, I sincerely appreciate it. Thank you so much, Tristan. I'm so excited to finally have you on the show, and I'm even more excited because we are going to be watching one of my personal favorite movies, which you haven't seen, and that's Stand By Me. Now, you actually suggested this for the episode. Mm-hmm. What prompted that? Was there it was almost immediate, because I was kind of like, I think I reached out to you and was like, hey, you know, I'd love to have you on the show. And we were just kind of talking about it. And you were like, well, I've never seen Stand By Me. It was almost immediate. So was this something you've been thinking about watching? Was it on your mind, or is it because it's fall and it kind of, those nostalgic feelings always come back during this time of year? What is it? What is it for you?
It was Family Guy.
Well, crap. All right.
You gave all these poetical images of, like, the leaves falling and the changing of colors and coming out of, you know, like growing into oneself.
Coming
of age and discovering who you are. No, it was Family Guy.
You picked the exact opposite of what I was setting up. The exact opposite.
That's what I do. That's good podcasting. My wife and I, we were watching cartoons, and we were watching some Seth MacFarlane cartoons. We were watching old Family Guy, and we were just kind of hitting them at random. And the Stephen King episode came up with, like, each act was parodied a Stephen King novel. I think the first one was Misery, then the second one was Stand By Me, and the third one was Shawshank Redemption. And as my wife and I were talking to each other, we both turned to each other and said, almost at the same time, I've never seen Stand By Me. And I said, I was like, yeah, I'm kind of ashamed that that I haven't seen Stand By Me. And that's when I texted you. That's when I said, I was like, hey, we should do this.
That's fantastic. It's funny because I didn't know it was a Stephen King short story. And I've since read the short story. I went through kind of a Stephen King phase a couple years ago, and I read different seasons, which includes The Body, which is what became Stand By Me. It also includes, I think it's Rita Hayworth in The Shawshank Redemption, which of course became The Shawshank Redemption. Apt pupils in there. And then there's a fourth one, and nobody remembers the fourth one because it's not a movie, and it's definitely the weakest of those four. I don't even remember what the title is. I thought I was on a roll there, but I honestly don't remember what it is, but it's okay. Nobody does. But
I didn't know Apt Pupil was Stephen King.
Yeah, isn't that crazy?
That is crazy.
I haven't seen that, and I would love to see it. But yeah, very, very good. Different Seasons is fantastic, and I highly recommend it. But it's funny, I remember, I think my first memory of Stand By Me was, like, in a Blockbuster, just seeing it, like, browsing the movie selection and looking at the cover and being like, oh, they're kids on this movie. I'm a kid. I like movies about kids. I looked at the back and I was like, oh, it's rated R. How interesting. And I just remember thinking, like, how there was this weird, like, but the cover is so sweet and innocent and they're smiling. How can this, like, innocent movie be rated R? That was, like, I mean, again, this is where my child brain went to immediately. So that was my first exposure to the movie. And then I caught it on cable just by accident. This was a few years later. I was out of high school by this point, about to go into film school, and it was on TV. And I'm a huge sucker for coming of age stories, and I hadn't quite realized how much I loved coming of age. I think Stand By Me kind of cemented it for me. It kind of hit all the right notes for me. And I mean, it's a quintessential coming of age story, but I'd never seen it before. It was just on TV, and I was like, oh yeah, that R-rated movie I used to stare at as a kid at Blockbuster, I'll go ahead and watch this. And it just completely blew me away, and I went out and bought the DVD the next day to watch the actual film. But that may have been my first, now that I think about it, Stand By Me might have been my first Stephen King adaptation, which is kind of crazy. I hadn't seen The Shining. I hadn't seen Shawshank. I hadn't seen Misery, which was also directed by Rob Reiner and is also fantastic. But this is my first Stephen King adaptation.
I think my first one was The Shining, which you and I have actually talked about before.
Yes.
On Filibuster. And
speaking of Filibuster, we should definitely plug that show and plug the Nerd Party in general. So Tristan, you do a couple great shows on the Nerd Party. So why don't you tell the good folks at home about those shows?
Well, thank you very much. I host two shows, one called Nerd Nuptial, which I host with my wife, and we look at geek life through a married lens. It's a lot of fun. We review a lot of movies, a lot of TV, and we throw in some personal stories in it as well. And I also host a show called Punch It, Writing in Star Trek with Charlene Schmidt. And we tackle stories and topics of Star Trek. One of our favorite things to do is that we take a story and rewrite it, or we take an episode and rewrite it, fix it, punch it up, or we write it on the fly. And one of the things that I want to plug is, like, besides just those two shows that I host, is an episode that you and I did together along with John Mills, who you can find also on the network at Aggressive Negotiations, as well as Great Shot Kid. And we talk all things The Shining, everything about The Shining, from Kubrick's directing it to Jack Nicholson starring in it, and behind the scenes information, the influence it had on us growing up and being at film school. And everyone should check it out. Go to thenerdparty.com to check out all of these things. And you can find us on our social networks on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and you can get all those handles by going to thenerdparty.com.
Spoken like a true member of the Nerd Party. Beautiful. But seriously, these are great shows, and I highly encourage everyone to check them out. Love Nerd Nuptial. It's so much fun to listen to you and the girl chat and what's a good volley? Is volley the right word? When you guys start to get really into it, when you're on two opposing sides of an opinion, it's an absolute delight. And Punch It is so much
fun.
Those
are my favorite episodes, yeah.
Yes, those are the best ones. And Punch It is great because I love writing, and I just love listening to what you two come up with. So,
thank you.
Again, listen to everything. We're just going to, Tristan and I are going to spend this episode just praising each other, because that's what we do, and that's what the people want. But, now that I think about it, because, we talked a little bit, there's The Shining, there's Misery, there's Shawshank. Stephen King has some pretty awful adaptations. Those are not anywhere near awful. They're all masterpieces. And even amongst all those amazing names, I have to say Stand By Me might be my favorite. And it's really the coming of age thing. That's really what it is for me. Shining and Shawshank Redemption are absolute masterpieces, but I think at the end of the day, I just love the I just love the story of these kids, and just the general plot is basically one of them finds out about a dead body. Some kid went off and got killed, and they're like, let's go see this dead body, and they just go on a little hiking trip together. And it's really, really wonderful and simple and beautiful, and really captures growing up. Has a lot of nice little, like, 50s quirks as well. Great music. It's amazing because this was Rob Reiner's, I think, his third movie. And he'd done This Is Spinal Tap, which is a movie I cannot recommend enough. And then he did the Sure Thing after that, which I've never seen, but John Cusack was in that, and John Cusack is also makes a brief appearance in Stand By Me. And this film has an amazing cast. I mean, Will Wheaton, this was kind of his first big thing, and probably the best performance he's done. As much as I know everybody loves Wesley Crusher, I think this performance might take it. And Jerry O'Connell, who's a little chubby kid in this movie, which is so funny because I had a complete disconnect. I was like, oh, isn't that the like hunky guy who like dates? Didn't he date Tara Reid? I don't know.
Oh, well, he's married to Rebecca Romijn.
He is. Okay, well, there you go. So it's amazing to watch this film. And, you know, I think it's an inspirational film because kids can watch this and be like, I'm a little chubby. I'm a little nerdy. But someday I can grow up and marry Rebecca Romijn. So I think that's
in the Family Guy spoof. They actually get Richard Dreyfuss to narrate the spoof.
Oh, my God.
And
that's great.
Like at the end of the spoof, they say they say the chubby character's name. And they're like, and this guy, he grew up to marry Rebecca Romijn. I'm not even kidding. Look it up, okay? Isn't that just a kick in the slacks, okay? You know, it's just like, it was amazing. It was absolutely amazing.
That's fantastic.
Now, speaking of Will Wheaton, every time I think of Will Wheaton in this movie, which, again, I haven't seen because this is missing frames, I think about this Robot Chicken sketch where they're all, like, they're in a boardroom and it's supposed to be like the TNG's writer's room. And they're like there's this one guy who's voiced by Nathan Fillion. He's like, what do we do? People hate Wesley Crusher. You know, like people just can't stand his character. What do we do? And they're like, one person's like, well, why don't we just fire him? He's like, we can't fire him. His contract is ironclad and dipped in gold. All that Stand By Me heat.
It's the truth. I love Will Wheaton. I honestly, and I mean this with all due respect, I don't think he topped this performance. I really think this is great. And then Kiefer Sutherland is in this movie too.
I didn't know that.
He's constantly angry. He's running around blowing things up. No, none of that happens in this film.
And he has his satchel, his bottomless satchel.
Exactly. So he's well prepared. This movie taught him and trained him and honed him for a life in the Secret Service. I don't know. I've never seen 24. Is that what he does? Is he in the Secret Service?
No, he's not in the Secret Service. He's CTU, the Counterterrorism Unit. Come on.
It's all the same. It's all the same. The point is, you are alive when they start to eat you. No, the point is that Kiefer Sutherland got his crazy action hero chops from being terrifying in this movie. I don't know if that's true, but I'm just going to go ahead and say it anyway.
I'm really embarrassed right now. The point is, they're alive when they start to eat the raptors. The raptors. It's from Jurassic Park.
Yes,
okay.
Yes.
Jeez. For a second, I was just like, wait, I know that. What is that from? Stand By Me is one of those movies where I feel like I've seen all of it. I've seen every single second of it, but out of sequence. You know, like it's one of those movies that it was constantly played on loop on TNT or TBS or something like that. And
right.
I would just catch it walking through the house or doing laundry or something like that. I never started it. I never finished it. It was just always, I would get 15-minute chunks. Maybe not
even. You
know
what's... You know what's funny about that is that, you know, we did the Princess Bride episode. I did that with my wife, which is another Rob Reiner movie. And it's the exact, that was my experience with the Princess Bride before I finally sat down and watched it for Missing Frames, is that I'd always watched it out of sequence. I never actually seen it from beginning to end. I wonder, maybe that's just a Rob Reiner thing. Maybe his movies are just always on television because they're also like A Few Good Men, another Rob Reiner movie. That's one I'd never seen all the way through for a long time, but I'd always seen, like, The Courtroom Case was always on television. So I was like, well, I gotta watch it. Reiner has a great filmography. It's very hard to pick a favorite. And like I said, I just saw The Princess Bride, which is now absolutely one of my favorite films. But man, Stand By Me, When Harry Met Sally, those are maybe the top ones for me. So I'm excited. I haven't watched Stand By Me in a few years now. Man, it's been a while. So I'm very excited to watch it again. So where are you at excitement-wise? Are you looking forward to it? Is it really something you've been wanting to watch? Or how do you feel?
Eh. No, to be honest, I am, this is one of those movies where, and there's a lot of those movies where you sit down and, like, as a film nerd, as a huge film geek and, you know, former film student and people who, an individual who is obsessed with movies and storytelling, this is one of those classics. This is one of those movies that you are ashamed that you haven't seen and you need to rectify it, even if you're not excited about it, even if you know you're not going to like it, which I'm not saying that that's the case with Stand By Me, but I know that they're like, you look at AFI's top 100 and you're just like, I know I'm going to hate this one. I know that this is going to be a horrible time, but I got to watch it. I got to see right. it. I got to right. log it away. And speaking of shame, that was actually one of the original titles for this show. Have you told anybody that, like, film shaming? Was
film shaming,
like,
we should. Because that was the idea. The idea of Missing Frames was, you know, like, oh my God, how can you not have seen this? So I think that was an early idea of, like, you know, people shame you all the time for movies you haven't seen. So I still think we can maybe Missing Frames, the shame of cinema or something like that. We can fit it in somewhere. It doesn't make sense that it's the shame of cinema, but, you know, whatever. We'll figure it out.
Whatever. Regardless. We're looking at a little behind the scenes of Missing Frames here. But yeah, with Stand By Me, I'm excited to see these actors at a young age. I'm excited to see another Stephen King story that I haven't seen all the way through. You know, like, am I jazzed about it? No, but I'm excited to watch it and then talk about it with you, because that means I get to come back and do the second half of this show.
Well, we'll see about that. So let's watch it. Let's take it one step at a time. Let's go watch the movie first, and then I'll decide if we can come back and talk about it. Although, spoiler alert, that's going to happen. So stay tuned, everybody.
Now available to own on video cassette.
And we're back. Tristan has just seen Stand By Me for the first time. Mr. Riddell, what did you think of Stand By Me?
I feel older. I feel 13. I feel like I've grown. I feel like I've taken a journey, and I am now frightened of the woods.
I thought, well, that's Blair Witch usually has that effect on people.
Oh, right. Wait, movie. that's what we were supposed to watch, right?
Oh, no. Oh, no. We're in trouble. Oh, can we start this episode over? Is this live?
Speaking of Missing Frames, I actually have never seen the Blair Witch Project. Not a single frame.
We should do that. You haven't seen a single frame. You haven't seen a single missing frame of Blair Witch Project.
Like, you and I are the same age, and it came out at this time when, you know, like, we were young enough where we would take, you know, girls to horror movies on dates, and, like, everybody was obsessed with going to horror movies in the theater.
You were going on dates at that age? I was like, no one's talking to me.
Wait, how old were we when that came out?
I was 12, 11 or 12.
Oh, okay. Maybe I'm a little bit older than you then.
Maybe you are, Tristan. And I'm glad we're talking about the Blair Witch Project. So far this episode, everyone's like, wait a second.
Let's dial it back. So yes, I saw Stand By Me for the first time. Yeah, I was actually quite surprised at how short it was. It's only 88 minutes. And it's it was like you were talking about, it's a Rob Reiner film. It very much feels like a Rob Reiner film. Although I was not expecting all of the cursing.
Yeah, that's what earned it its R rating, pretty much. I mean, that's single-handedly. There are a couple, like, tense dramatic moments, and the leech moment is pretty, like, gah. But for the most part, yeah. I think you probably could have passed with a PG, except for the fact that they swear so much.
They swear like little prepubescent sailors. It's insane.
I think, I don't know if this was, I mean, Stephen King, I honestly can't remember the novella that well, but, like, Stephen King's convinced that children talk like that all the time. I don't remember talking like that, but I knew some kids. But the 50s, I'm not so sure. 50s, it was, like, squeaky clean. Or so we've been led to believe by our lying parents.
Yeah, and our lying cinema. I asked myself that question as I was watching it. I was like, okay, I was once a 12-year-old boy. I was once friends with, you know, 12-year-old boys in my group. Did we swear like that? I honestly can't remember. I remember being in late elementary school, early middle school. I remember, like, hearing that kind of language and going like, whoa, hey, calm down, folks. Okay.
Like, we're civilized children. Good Lord. Keep it G-rated. You know, it's funny. It never really, the cursing never really bothered me that much. I always, it was always kind of like, oh, they're kids and they're all kind of subconsciously competing with each other and trying to out, like, do each other as like, yeah, I'm really cool. No, I'm really cool. Like, so the smoking and the swearing was like, felt like it was part of that culture at the, or when you're a young boy, you're always trying to like out cool your friends, and those are like two of the very cool adult things to do. So that's what I always perceived it as.
I'm surprised like some kid didn't bring like a bottle of Jack, you know, like just like, yeah.
Exactly.
And I brought this hooker named Candy, you know, like, this will be fun.
This is gonna be the best road trip ever. But did you did you enjoy the film?
Yes. It was, yeah. I mean, I'm glad I watched it.
You sound
it.
Uncertain.
No, I was just, I wasn't in love with it. Like, when I finished it, I wasn't like, oh my gosh, this changed my life. This was an amazing film. I was glad I watched it, and because it was a missing frame, I was like, okay, box checked, fantastic. I've seen Stand By Me. And I don't feel the need to ever watch it again.
Wow. Well, that's interesting. I had the maybe exact opposite. I mean, we already knew I loved it. We talked about that already. But watching it, I haven't seen it in a while. And watching it again, I was just extremely profoundly moved by it and like fell in love with it all over again. I don't know if you have a movie where you've done this, where you've shown it, you see it once, and then you obsess over it and you show it to people and you watch it like 50 times in a row. That was basically, I saw this movie and I showed it to everyone I could think of in my social circle. And I'd seen it within maybe a month or two, about 10 times. So it felt like it had worn out its welcome. I was like, yeah, I like this movie, but I'm good. So watching it again, it was one of those experiences where you feel like enough time has passed. I feel like that happened here for me, where I kind of was reminded of like, oh my god, that's right, I love this movie, and this is, I don't know why I would expect anything otherwise. I don't think I expected to not like it, but it was definitely a pleasant surprise to watch it and kind of find that it still worked on all the levels that had worked for me before, and sometimes even a little bit more so than it had before. I don't know. I feel like as I'm getting older, I'm not that old, people, but I mean, I just hit my 30s, so I'm kind of like, oh my gosh, what is happening in my life? And I think watching, as I continue to watch this movie as I get older, it'll be more and more poignant for me.
So who do you I feel like everyone, like every guy who watches this film has to relate to one of the four. I mean, like, it's a pretty good cross section of the American you know, like suburban Midwest, whatever, you know, like, not, I guess it wasn't in the Midwest, but you know what I'm trying to say, like that kind of like small town feel, like everyone has their own person that they relate to, this cross section. So who do you relate to out of the four?
Man, there's a part of every one of those kids. Like I was thinking about it because I was like, oh, I'm going to ask Tristan this, and then you beat me to the punch. But it's because it's a great question. There's really, like, I could find pieces of their personalities in my life. But really, if I had to pick one, Gordy, like, that's absolutely just wanting to be a writer and also having, and this is something I've picked up on before, but especially now that I've recognized it in my life and in my past, and I've talked about it a lot, but the whole angle of him having a very an older brother who was loved by the community, loved by his parents, you know, a football star. He was, you know, one of the most popular kids in school. Like, everybody loved him. And he had these very obvious, like, traits that made it easy to love in that time. Mm-hmm. And then you have Gordy, who is very, like, he's a writer. He's imaginative, but hasn't really found himself yet. And that pressure on him to find himself and to have a label on himself, without really knowing what that is, and feeling kind of worthless as a result of that, that, is something I can very strongly relate to. This is like a really depressing episode so far. No, but it's true. I mean, I think a lot of people can relate to that. And, you know, he wants to be a writer, which is obviously something that I can relate to. But I think just the angle of being young and being not and feeling like you see, oh, this guy's going to be a doctor. This guy's going to be this. You know, you can put people in categories and not knowing where you belong and feeling very out of place about it. I remember there, I got this movie was consistently choking me up as I watched it, which is crazy because I've seen it before and I know what happens. But at the most interesting moments, the scene where he is buying their food supply, and the guy says, "Oh, you're I can't remember John Cusack's character's name, Denny. You're Denny's brother, aren't you?" And he's like, "Yeah." And he goes, "Oh, Denny was such a great kid. By the way, what, so, you know, he did football, he did all this, what do you do?" And Gordy just goes, "I don't know." And I don't know why, but it affected me really deeply, because it's such a strange thing to ask such a young kid, but to put that pressure on a kid, and those feelings and his journey through the movie to kind of find himself. I relate very strongly to that. Chris, I've known a lot of Chris's in my life, and yeah. I feel a strong kinship to their relationship, because I feel like I've had a lot of people kind of guiding me and encouraging me through that. But there are bits and pieces of all those characters. Like I can, Teddy's anger, like the frustration he feels at people making fun of his dad. Not that anyone's made fun of my dad to me, but that kind of, that youthful kind of like unbridled juvenile anger. I've felt that at points in my life. So all four. And then I'm also just a goofball and stupid like Vern. So it's really, it's hard to pick one, but if I had to, I'd say Gordy easily. But what about you?
It's my answer is much simpler. It's Vern, hands down. Like I am so much Vern in so many ways, especially as a kid and even kind of now, because Vern, like, I loved Vern so much. I thought he was hysterical. I thought he was so, so innocent and pure.
I lost the comb.
And like, and when he's running on the train tracks, that look on his face terror.
You want to know what's interesting about that? That was sheer terror, because when they were shooting that scene, the two of them, Will Wheaton and Jerry O'Connell, were not quite up to par with looking as scared or horrified as Rob Reiner wanted. And Rob Reiner got so frustrated that this is the one time he like raised his voice at the kids. And he was basically like, "These cameramen have been shoving this camera around. They're tired. They don't want to do it anymore. And it's your fault. And if you're not afraid that train's going to come get you, well, don't worry, because if you don't do this take right, I'm gonna come get you." And apparently their reaction, like, they started crying and he's like, roll camera, and that reaction of them genuinely terrified is a result of that. But he also adds at the end that they were not traumatized. They ran up to him afterwards and were very happy, and we're like, "We did it," and they all hugged and they were all happy.
But okay, so it had a happy ending.
Exactly. I think it wasn't just him yelling at children.
I was gonna say, like, Rob Reiner is totally like everybody's video, like a movie dad, you know, like, it's
exactly, so it's a terrible, I'm destroying that image, but I just think that's so funny.
but yeah, with Vern, it's with me specifically, with how I grew up, it's that I had a fantastic childhood. Like, I just had one of the best childhoods. I had a loving family. My parents were super supportive of everything I wanted to do. Like, any creative endeavor that I wanted to attempt, they were just right behind me, you know, cheering me on, and they paid attention to me, and I had a great relationship. I still do. I have a great relationship with my sister. I talk with her every day, and I, you know, like, I was the goofy kid. I was the clown. I was the one cracking jokes. Now, I wasn't as nerdy as Vern. Like, I was
as just oblivious as he is.
I think that's a good way to put it. I wasn't as oblivious as Vern, but I was definitely just as goofy. And right. I was actually started thinking about it. I was like, my parents have robbed me of being a profound artist, I think, because I have no excuse to go to a therapist. I have no excuse to go on Oprah and, you know, blame them for whatever issues are in my life. And
you haven't lived until you can blame everything on your parents.
I know, right? And so like with Teddy, like, man, I really can't relate to Teddy.
Sure.
Because, and thank goodness I can't.
Right. Well, the abuse angle, that sounds, I mean, it sounds terrible for me to be like, yeah, I can relate to Teddy as if my parents abused me, which is not the case in the slightest. It's more that, like, kind of, I don't know. Teddy, I can't relate to as strongly as Gordy, but I just see, like, as a kid, I remember being very angry. Mostly as I moved from middle school into high school, I got really angry. And that, it's almost like unjustified, and not that his anger was unjustified, but it's yeah. like this kind of like raw, like you just like have such like resentment, and it's all built up, and it's fascinating. I know Corey Feldman said that this movie is probably the closest to capturing what he was like at any given point in his life. And I mean, really? Now you, I mean, with all this stuff coming out about him, and it's no surprise. I mean, he grew up in like the cocaine cloud fueled Hollywood age as a child, and he went through some horrible stuff. It's not too difficult to see where he kind of pulled from for that performance and making that performance as authentic as it is.
Yeah, and with Gordy, I think the main thing that stuck with me about Gordy is his relationship with his father and the trauma that he yeah. went through. And I have a great relationship with my dad, and I haven't really gone through any trauma growing up. Like, I've lost I've lost family members, but like a cousin, an uncle, a grandfather, you know, and everything like that, but never like a sibling or a parent or something
yeah.
like that.
Yeah.
And no, I know that there are many other aspects of Gordy. Like, you laid out a very good example of why you relate with Gordy. But like when I wanted to write or create films or do any kind of other art or anything like that, like I had a big support system that cheered me mm-hmm. on. And so I was just like, cool, I can do this. Like,
oh yeah, no, I definitely had a support system. I think it's the idea of relating to someone who, I can see the struggle of someone trying to find themselves, and especially me when I was that age, and trying to figure out, like, as you know, I have a brother who's a fantastic human being, but he was way more into sports and things like that than I was. And right around that point, I had been playing sports, but right around that point, I decided, I'm like, I'm done doing sports. I don't know what I want to do. So the pressure you feel, I don't know if you felt this, but there is a kind of pressure on a kid. It's like, all right, what do you want to be when you grow up? And it's like when you're like, oh, how do I make movies? How do I do that? And they're kind of like, haha, but really, what do you actually want to do? And it's like, so I think that's the element I definitely relate to, and that disillusionment or just kind of aimlessness. Like, no, well, it's not even aimlessness. It's just the feeling that you're just trying to find your place in the world, which is really what this whole movie is about. I mean, it's kind yeah. of it is one of the quintessential coming of age movies, and they all kind of have to go through. It's funny, except for Vern. Vern never really has a moment. He is what he is, which yeah. is kind of fantastic. But each one of them has a moment where they kind of, it's like their trial by fire, where, you know, with Chris, he has his moment where he admits that basically this adult kind of screwed him over and it really messed him up. Teddy with his dad and having to face down the junkyard guy and screaming at him. And then Gordy at the end when he has his breakdown, and then when he has a showdown with Ace and kind of stands up for the rest of the group. But it's very moving. The whole thing was very, I keep saying that, but it was very surprising to me. I, having seen this so many times, to watch it again and be so like emotionally in tune with the film, it was very fulfilling viewing experience for me.
Yeah, I remember
nice when you can return to
as I was
like
watching
that.
It I was like, yeah, there's a lot of crying in this movie. There's a lot of
everyone cries.
There's a
everyone
lot of emotions
nice
yeah
yeah lots of let don't this is the ultimate, like, guys, it's not even bros, it's like kids with real emotions crying, and it's okay. Usually and kids crying annoys the crap out of me.
It's true. I'm not a big fan of kids in movies. Like, that's probably why I haven't seen Stand By Me for so like until now, is because I just don't like kid actors. I've worked with kid actors, and I just, it is as horrible as it sounds. And it's, I can never believe a child actor when I see them on screen. But it really wasn't until Stranger Things where I was just like, oh, okay, yeah, no, I can totally get behind kid actors.
Stranger Things is a very good one. I think Stand By Me, I think the kids are pretty fantastic. I really do think that. I think River Phoenix is definitely a standout, but I think all four of them are great in their own way, and I really love Will Wheaton. I think, I mean, obviously I've been singing the praises of Gordy, but I think Will Wheaton, it's funny because he does get kind of beat up for The Next Generation. And I know Will Wheaton is a passionate listener of this podcast, but I don't want to insult him. No, I can understand people who watch that show and are like, Will Wheaton. But I watched this movie and I'm very, very impressed. And it's all four of them are great, but especially he and River Phoenix really carry the movie emotionally. And they have some pretty heavy hitting scenes where that's a fine line where you have to balance, like you said, kids acting can be a painful thing. Kids crying can be a very painful thing, because if you, a kid who is not capable of conjuring up those emotions is extremely obvious. And I could probably count on both my hands moments where kids actually pulled it off. But, I think that is one of the most impressive things about this film, is the fact that these four kids who hadn't really acted that much except for River Phoenix and Corey Feldman were able to kind of carry this movie the way they did.
I think one thing that surprised me as I was watching it was I was like, oh, okay, man, Richard Dreyfuss is in this. He's not just an area where we actually see him. And then I'm like, oh, wait, is that? Who is that in the picture? Is that John Cusack? Holy crap, it is John Cusack. And they're like, Kiefer Sutherland just walked out of the shop? What is going... Who is not in this movie?
I know, it is a fantastic cast. I love it. And I forgot Richard Dreyfuss was in it. I was so happy in the opening scene. I was like, oh, that's right. I love him. He was in Jaws.
This is one of those things that is always frustrating to me. And there's nothing you can do about it. There's absolutely nothing you can do about it. But... is like when you see a child actor and a famous person portrays them at an older age, but then that child actor grows up and you know who that person is and what they look like, you're just like, wow, Will Wheaton looks nothing like Richard Dreyfuss.
It's the magic of the movies. It's the beauty. I think it's the true beauty of Stand By Me, is the fact that we believe that Will Wheaton could grow up to be Richard Dreyfuss, that is plausible. I think that was the whole point, is that you believe in it. And Rob Reiner is a genius for making us believe that. But you know what? Speaking of Rob Reiner, I think we talked a little bit about it in the pre-show, just like the movies he's done. I was talking with my wife, Sarah, who was kind of watching this, walking in and out as I was watching this movie and commenting. And at the end of it, I was like, you know, we talk about great filmmakers, and there are so many. I mean, obviously, we nerd out about all the great Spielberg and Scorsese and Kubrick and Nolan and all these amazing filmmakers. Does it feel like nobody mentions Rob Reiner in that same sentence? Because I just want to have a moment to kind of gush about the guy for a little bit, because I mean, he has made some of the greatest films I've ever seen. And I mean, this is Spinal Tap, Stand By Me, Princess Bride, When Harry Met Sally, Misery, A Few Good Men, even The American President I really enjoy, which is kind of almost under the radar. And I know he's kind of fallen out of favor and he hasn't really made a good movie since that. Since American President. Did you see that?
That's
one
what
Michael
I was
Douglas?
Gonna say. Like I was gonna say, I was like, he has not made a good movie since 1995.
Yeah, and that was Aaron Sorkin too, wasn't it? Didn't he write that?
That's right.
Yeah, so great combination. But it's like, is it something where it's like, do you have to keep making great movies consistently to be considered a great director? Because I feel like, and this is no offense to this gentleman, because I think he's made some of the great films of all time, but Ridley Scott is basically coasting on on Alien and Blade Runner, and he's been doing it his whole career. And I like Gladiator. I think Black Hawk Down is okay. But I The Martian I enjoyed, and he's done a couple decent ones, but I feel like his whole career has coasted on those first two big movies he made, whereas somebody like Rob Reiner, like all those movies I listed, you could call them masterpieces. You could call them classics. I don't know. What is it? Why don't we like Rob Reiner more? I feel like people should be talking about him more. Is it because he hasn't made a great movie since 95?
It's because he hasn't made a great movie since 1995. I mean, like, that's just it, man. It's just, and
it's a shame.
I feel like I have to defend Ridley Scott a little bit because, like, where Rob Reiner made, you know, like, fantastic films like, you know, like A Few Good Men and When Harry Met Sally and The Princess Bride, because these are all movies that are very much in the zeitgeist, like in Misery and everything like that. Like, we talk about these movies. These movies are in our culture and are referenced constantly in other movies and in pop culture and everything like that. But when you look at his latest works, you have Shock and Awe, LBJ, Being Charlie, you know, and...
He did a couple really awful, like, Kate Hudson.
Rumor has it, The Bucket List, yeah. The Story of Us, you know, and he just made bad decision after bad decision. Now, when you look at Ridley Scott, though, you know, like, he is constantly working. I think that's the biggest thing, is that he's constantly working. We're constantly talking about him. And in 1995, or at least like around then, like I'm trying, like if you look at what he was doing.
Like Thelma and Louise, did that come out in like
91?
Is that late 91?
Thelma and Louise was in 91, and he kind of took a break for 4 years from 92 to 96. And then he made G.I. Jane in 97 and then Gladiator in 2000. And then, so after that, you have, you know, Hannibal, Black Hawk Down, Matchstick Men, Kingdom of Heaven, A Good Year, American Gangster, Body of Lies, Robin Hood, Prometheus, The Counselor, Exodus, Martian, Covenant. So it's pretty much hit, miss, hit, miss, hit, miss, hit, miss for a long time. And with Rob Reiner since 95, it's been miss, 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 miss.
Yeah, but I'm like a firm believer of like it's the same with Irvin Kershner, where it's like he made The Empire Strikes Back and that's it. You know, it's like RoboCop 2. Nope. You know, and Never Say Never Again. But I liked
Never Say Never Again as a kid.
I'll be honest. I haven't seen it. I've seen parts of it, so I can't really say that for sure.
I'm not defending it. I'm just saying I liked it.
I feel like somebody who has made so many great movies deserves to be in that conversation. And the thing about Ridley Scott is he's a filmmaker. Like Rob Reiner is not a visual auteur. Like, I know I shouldn't say that word. David Fincher has outlawed the word auteur, so I shouldn't be using it. But I mean, Ridley Scott is beyond just being a great filmmaker. He pioneered a whole new visual language for like science fiction. I mean, the guy took it to a whole other level. Whereas Rob Reiner, his movies are pretty much standard storytelling. But I think there's something to be appreciated there. A movie director doesn't necessarily have to be like wowing you with amazing visuals to make a great movie. And I think Sidney Lumet in his book Making Movies said, you know, the director, he's like, I think it's impressive when a director can do that, but I like to get out of the way. I like to take my ego out of the equation, and I like to just tell the story and do whatever I can to tell that story. And I feel like, especially like with these early films, like the ones we've listed as being classics, the guy has made some really incredible, solid movies. And I want to give him a hug. I don't know.
I think there's another reason why we don't talk about his filmmaking as much as like other people, like because we keep going back to Ridley Scott. How many times have you seen Ridley Scott in front of the camera?
Not as often as I'd like, because, man, he is angry and bitter. Well, you know, every behind the scenes, he looks so upset.
Well, you know what I mean, though? Like, he's not an actor. He's a director. Rob Reiner has been in way more stuff in front of the camera than he has behind the camera.
Well, he started as an actor.
Yeah, and exactly. He started as an actor. So when we think about him, like when we think Rob Reiner, we think, oh, okay, he's the guy who's in This is Spinal Tap. This is the guy who is was on the Larry Sanders Show. Like, he was the one who made a guest appearance on Frasier and in, you know, like, in Curb Your Enthusiasm. And
people could pick Rob Reiner out. Like, you, if you saw him, you'd be like, oh, yeah, wait, he directed? It's kind of like, it's almost like Ron Howard in a way, where you say, Ron, that's when someone says, oh, I love Apollo 13, and you say, yeah, it was directed by Ron Howard. They're like, Happy Days, Ron Howard? And you're like, yeah. And they're like, that's the same guy? I feel like Rob Reiner is not, I think Ron Howard is a more recognizable name than Rob Reiner, but it's a similar situation where people, there is a disconnect there where people forget, like, oh, that's the same Ron Howard.
Yeah, I think, yeah, that, I think that's pretty, I think that's a pretty good comparison, but you're even, you're proving your point even more, because when you say Ron Howard, to most people, people go like, oh yeah, the Da Vinci Code guy, or, you know, like that thing. But with Rob Reiner, you're just kind of like, what? Like, you know, what exactly?
Yeah,
did you
but
do
at,
you know?
But at the same time, I mentioned Sidney Lumet, and if you mention Sidney Lumet to somebody, they'll go, huh, what? But if you say 12 Angry Men, Dog Day Afternoon, people are like, oh my God, yeah. Or Network, all of a sudden. Same thing with Rob Reiner. I think it's the difference between an auteur filmmaker and just a great filmmaker. And I feel like, because Rob Reiner did not revolutionize cinematic language the same way somebody like Spielberg or Lucas or Coppola or Scorsese did, I feel like we forget to include him in that conversation. I'm basically using this episode as a soapbox to make a bid to make sure we include Rob Reiner in conversations of great directors, because I think he deserves it.
All right.
Then, and on that note, thank you for tuning in. No, let's get back to Stand By Me. I've talked too much about Rob Reiner. He should send me a check. So do you have like so you're watching the movie, you kind of, you enjoyed it, you didn't love it, but was there a moment where that kind of won you over as like, okay, yeah, I'm into this, I like this? Was there a moment that charmed your cold heart?
The moment where I was just like, okay, I'm on board, like I'm digging this, is when Vern brought out the comb for the first time. He's like, I brought a comb in case we're on TV. I was like, that is such kid thinking. That's so amazing.
And I also love when he goes, when they're like, why didn't you bring food? And he's like, I can't think of everything, I brought the comb.
That's what I was gonna say, was my favorite line from the film, is like, what am I supposed to do, think of everything? I brought the comb.
So what you're saying is, I'm saying Rob Reiner is a great director, you're saying Vern is the great character in cinema.
Oh yeah, he's practically Faustian in his importance.
I love that.
And then when you look at like how Vern grew up and what Jerry O'Connell looks like now, and the dude married Rebecca Romijn, you're just like, what?
It's a beautiful thing. I'm telling you, it's inspiring. That's the whole point. Like I said, it inspires children to like dream big. It's not everything is within reach.
Yeah, dream big and stay active. Go, go outside and play, work out a little bit.
It could happen to you. I honestly could. I can't pick. I was, you know, like I said, the first time I saw this it was on television, and I always tune in when there's something about like I've said, I'm a sucker for coming of age stories. And whenever I see a movie that's about kids growing up, kids chatting with each other, kids like discovering life and like pain and suffering and coming through these like rites of passage, I always tune into it. So it was almost, I mean, I was immediately on board when I saw it. I think if I had to pick a favorite scene, I probably couldn't. I love the moment with Chris. I think when he kind of has his breakdown, and I think River Phoenix is brilliant in that. I love when they're sitting around the campfire and talking about, wait, what the hell is Goofy? And I think, I don't know if this is true, but a lot of people have said this. Apparently that was kind of one of the first moments in film where a bunch of characters just sat around and chatted about like pop culture and like irrelevant, like things that didn't really move the plot forward, but kind of like things that people like the Tarantino kind of thing, where it's like, oh, we'll just talk about this movie for a whole scene, or we'll talk about this. That I can't say for sure, I don't know for sure, but apparently this film, that scene, was a pioneer for that kind of like conversational sit like that kind of moment in a film, which is kind of awesome.
I think I'd be willing to believe that if it had the qualification of with children. I think because like just improvising lines, there's no way that was like,
well, not improvising lines, but just the not like like, oh, improvise anything, but just the like a conversational, like, here are just some kids talking about things that kids talk about, instead of like, okay, we have to now do this thing that is going to move the plot forward. I think a lot of people have cited that scene as a influential scene for that reason, in that it was just a conversational, I guess I could call it the Richard Linklater thing, where it's like every one of his movies is just people talking to each other about like random stuff. Apparently, this movie was a big factor in kind of paving the way for those moments.
One thing that I did read about the movie was that there was a Renaissance fair going on nearby. Have you heard about this during filming?
No, tell me about this.
Kiefer Sutherland said in an interview, like, who knows if it's true because it's Kiefer Sutherland, he said that at one of the locations there was a Renaissance fair going on, and some of the cast and crew went and bought some cookies, and they gave them, you know, like to the cast and crew, but apparently like Jerry O'Connell ate the most of them. And they turned out
to be... Of course he did.
Yeah, they turned out to be pot cookies. And so he's in
I have heard this.
He's in the corner just crying his eyes out because he's just tripping balls. No. And just like...
That was the moment. That was what changed him. And that moment he said, I will grow up and marry Rebecca Romijn. I can see it. He had a vision of himself as a 30-year-old hot stud. And he knew. That's incredible.
So do you have a scene that sticks with you, like where ever since you saw it, when you think of Stand By Me, what's the scene that you think of? Is it when they find the body? Is it the leeches? What is it?
The leeches is great. I think of Stand By Me, I think a lot of just the silhouettes of them walking. It's mostly like that moment with kind of the, like, you know, golden summer day tint and all that. But I think the fire, the sitting around the fire, any scene where the four of them are together, just kind of like talking and stuff. But the moments that really stand with me are any scene between Chris and Gordy, where Chris is kind of giving him a pep talk. And especially at the end when Gordy comes up, and I love, one of my favorite lines in the movie is when he, you know, he has the gun and he's about to get him, and Kiefer Sutherland as Ace, he's like, what are you going to do, shoot all of us? And he goes, no, Ace, just you. And it's like, oh my God, now he's an action hero. But I love, it's such a beautiful story. Just these kids who are very innocent and very like, it's going to be fun. And as they kind of, as the movie goes on and they have that moment where they're like, maybe seeing a dead body isn't supposed to be like a fun adventure. And then at the end when they all kind of, silently almost agree, when it's kind of like, so should we turn it in? And Gordy's kind of like, no, this isn't the way to become a celebrity. And they decide to make it or not. It's just a very, very moving film. It's hard to pick a moment, a single moment. If I think of Stand By Me, I just think of the four of them walking on train tracks. I feel like that is the iconic thing about this movie if you were to pick an image. But as far as one scene goes, it's very tough because there's so many flavors to this movie, and there's so much comedic stuff, but there's also so much like heartbreaking stuff and very existential and like very, very, very lots of flavors. I said that, but you know, it's true. It's hard. But what about you? Is there something that really stood out to you that you'll always be like, you know what, Stand By Me, I enjoyed it, but what I really loved? And then how would you complete that sentence?
Well, I don't
know. The comb. It was the comb. I loved the comb.
Probably the comb. Yeah, I love the comb. No, like when I'm thinking of when I think of Stand By Me, when it pops into my head, I think of the train scene, like when they're running on the train tracks, and like, yeah, like first when they're walking and you see Verd and he's on all fours.
Oh yeah.
he's just like scurrying along, and then like Will Wheaton is screaming, we are going to die.
He has an Indiana Jones, we are going to die.
Amazing. Absolutely amazing. Yeah. And then like he pushes them up. I think that's probably the scene that I'm thinking of. But honestly, the thing that terrified me the most, that just like shook me to my core, is near the beginning when you see Chris pull out the gun for the first time. I'm like, these are 12-year-olds with a gun.
You couldn't, like, this movie only works in the 50s. I can't see a group of 12-year-old boys in this day and age, like, let's go out and walk on the train tracks. It's very much that it only works for that time period.
I think you're right because my wife, I watched this with my wife, and she was talking about the same thing where she's like, this film wouldn't be made today. And she started talking about the swearing and the gun and just like, I think the other thing was just like the very non-PC things that they said, like the insults that they hurled at each other and at people and the, you know, everything like that. And I think like It came out, you know, just recently, and you're like, oh, well, you know.
Oh, yeah. And it is totally, which is, I mean, again, it's Stephen King. So, right. I mean, they are, it has that same kind of vibe, but they're totally ripping from Stand By Me, or they're riffing on it. And I don't want to say ripping.
Not ripping,
that sounds more insulting.
Same,
yeah.
Yeah. It comes from the same,
author.
Yeah.
Exactly. But yeah, do you think you'd ever go back and read the source material? Any interest in it whatsoever?
Yeah, I might read the novella just to see where it differs and where it comes from and how much they tried to expand it, you know.
It's pretty similar. The big thing they changed, which I think is actually a good choice, is in the book, Chris is the one who shows showdowns with Ace and points the gun, and in the movie, it's Gordy. And it just makes more sense for an emotional journey and an emotional arc for Gordy to have the gun and have that showdown. I feel like if it had been Chris, it would have been like, oh, a cool moment, but it wouldn't have been as effective.
Right.
I know Stephen King was he commented on it and was like, you know, I always saw it as Gordy was like the inactive narrator, and he was just talking about Chris, this guy who he admired, who meant a lot to him growing up. But Rob Reiner, when he read the story and he read the script, he was like, oh, I see this as Gordy's story, and I relate to Gordy's character. I think that really drove him to make that scene happen and to make it about him and his journey to eventually at the end be the one to hold the gun on Ace and be like, get out of here. Speaking of that, do you have a favorite quote from this movie?
Yeah, you stole it from me. You it's the one where it's like, am I supposed to think of everything? I brought the comb.
I love that. I have a few. I've already said a couple of them. The No Ace, Just You is one of my favorites, but I love the when they're arguing about, do you think Mighty Mouse could take Superman? And Teddy just goes, Mighty Mouse is a cartoon. Superman's a real guy. That's why Superman would win. It's like, Superman's a real guy. Mighty Mouse is a cartoon. Of course, makes perfect sense. I think that might be one of my favorites, but there's a lot. Chopper Sick Balls is another one. I love that.
Yes.
it's great. But so I guess final ratings, trying to come up with a rating scale. You pick. Either we could do fat ones. How many fat ones would you give this? Or how many whimsical Richard Dreyfusses? Which one would you prefer?
I would give this 8 whimsical Dreyfusses out of 10 lard asses.
Okay. All right. So we'll add some lard ass in there too. I'll give it if I'm doing 5, I'll give it 5 across the board. Lard asses, fat ones, whimsical Richard Dreyfusses. I'll do that across the board. I'd really love it. I think it's fantastic. And I am excited to hear what our audience thinks about Stand By Me. Is it one of the great coming of age films of all time? Or are you a little bit more on Tristan's end where you're like, I liked it, but doesn't necessarily fall on my favorites? You can reach out to me at YeShonderman on Twitter. And Tristan, where can people find you?
Well, you can find me on Twitter as well, at The Insane Robin. You can also find me on this network by going to thenerdparty.com. You can find me on a show called Nerd Nuptial, which is a show that I host with my wife where we look at nerd life through a married lens. And I also host a Star Trek show called Punch It, Writing in Star Trek, with my friend Charlene Schmidt.
And they're looking to have Will Wheaton on that show someday. Here's what's going to happen. Will Wheaton's going to hear this episode and he's going to say, hey, that's a good idea, Sean. You're a genius. I'm going to go be on Tristan's show and I'm going to be like, wait, why aren't you on my show? And he's going to be like, shut up. He's going to say, suck my fat one, is what he's going to say to me.
Oh, good Lord.
I don't know. Do I have to bleep? I might have to bleep that. I don't know if that's offensive or terrible. but we'll see.
It could
we'll
be
see.
Both.
It's it could be both. It could be it's probably both. But Tristan, I think we've had a very successful first ever episode of Missing Frames together.
I think so too.
So I sincerely appreciate you being on the show. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. I'm glad you enjoyed the movie.
Every day seems a little longer. Every way love's a little stronger. Come what may, do you ever long for